Welcome to a special edition of Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. This is an Out to Coop extra, and I am recording from Kutztown University. This is Campus Equity Week, and it's a week where we get to highlight the conditions of adjunct faculty members across the country, and to hopefully redouble efforts to organize and kind of assert a very different vision of higher education than is what is out there for the most part. Well, right now I'm sitting here with Amy Lynch Bienyk. She is the chair of the statewide adjunct faculty committee for ABSCUF, and that is my union too as well. She's also the adjunct faculty chair here at Kutztown University, and someone who's in my department literally around the corner. So it's like it's a win-win. So welcome, Amy.
Thank you. You can't avoid me no matter what you do.
That's great. She's also, by the way, for those of you who tune in to Out to Coop for space news every week, Amy is also a top-level geek, so she's the one, and maybe, who knows, maybe I'll get her to talk a little about Star Trek Discovery at the end of this.
Did just tell my students that Neil deGrasse Tyson is my space husband.
There you have it. So, all right, so Amy, tell us a little bit about, a little bit of background of Campus Equity Week, right? Kind of what are we doing here this week? Because it's not just Kutztown, this is happening across the country.
Absolutely. Campus Equity Week is an event that has been organized every other year by a new faculty majority and the Coalition of Contingent Academic Labor, or COCAL. And you can read more about them at campusequity2017.com. And it's meant to draw attention to the inequities that we see across higher education. Our labor system has really set up two tiers of faculty. 25% of faculty nationwide are on the tenure track and have some amount of security in their job, whereas a whopping 75% now are on some kind of contingent contract. Now, what that means varies from place to place, but generally speaking, those faculty make significantly less than tenure-line faculty. They generally have little or no health benefits, no job security, and contracts that range anywhere from a single semester to 3 years.
Oh, good. So now we were talking a little bit about this earlier. So it's like, on the one hand, the whole idea about adjunct faculty, just to put this in a broader context, initially was like, okay, you know, maybe you want to bring in people from the outside for special courses. Maybe you want to bring in guest lecturers to teach particular courses or kind of fill in where there was need. But that is not the way that adjunct faculty exist in the system today. Right?
No, not at all. The AAUP just put out a great graphic. You can find it on their blog and website this past week, where they demonstrated how that shift has happened over the years, that indeed it used to be reversed. There used to be about 20% adjuncts working for exactly the reasons you mentioned, and it made sense. You have someone on sabbatical, you need a temporary replacement. You'd like to bring in a professional who has a certain amount of expertise in a career your students are training for. You'd like to have them in as a guest. But that's changed as administrators have realized how much more economically efficient it is to have instead legions of temporary workers working, flex workers, the same way they would in industry. Now, I don't think that education should be treated like industry, but if it is, then what we need to do is I think, band together and fight back the way a lot of unions do in industry to protect the rights of those workers.
Absolutely. And I think, one of the things that I think you see in higher education and what has, in some ways, helped bolster part of the kind of whole kind of adjunct model is because, you'd imagine if you were just having, piece workers come in and just pull people off the street in order to teach classes who don't know what they're doing, right? Then you're going to see a degradation of the quality of education. However, we've always had this kind of overlap with a kind of missionary kind of profession, right? Where we do what we do in higher education because we love it, right? We're committed to the work that's going in. So then what administrations, what higher education as an institution has been able to do is basically profit off of those folks who really care about their students, who are committed to the work they're doing, right? And often are doing incredible work in horrible conditions.
Yeah, in fact, some research has shown that adjunct professors are actually more successful at teaching general education courses. And in part, that's because those are the courses they're given to teach again and again and again. I mean, fighting in the trenches and teaching, you know, the freshman biology class, the intro to bio, or a freshman composition, you get good at it if you teach 5, 6, 7 classes a semester. So they are effective teachers, but that is really speaks to how hard they work, how much they are dedicated, given the fact that oftentimes they're in bullpen offices. They might share a computer. When I was an adjunct, I remember I shared a tiny office with 15 other professors. We had to use it in shifts because there weren't 15 desks. There were two. And we had one computer that we had to use in shifts. The fact that any of us were able to prep and get our work done was amazing. But again, it's testimony, as you said, to the kind of vocational nature that many of us go into this profession, not for the money, but right, because we love students, we love learning, we love education. And absolutely, the system is built to take advantage of that.
Yeah, it's actually, you know, the very kind of the love, that kind of commitment, the fact that people have not committed to this job just because you want to make a ton of money, but because you're actually committed to what you're doing, has been now used as kind of like a bludgeon against the very people that are, you know, charged to carry out a huge percentage of the general education, not even, and not just general education,
no,
to be clear,
no,
but, like primarily general education courses across the country. So, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you about was also, you know, here at Kutztown University, we recently had this story of an adjunct faculty member who was fired, right? Fired, what, 2-3 weeks into the semester after this individual found out that they had a life-threatening situation where they had to get surgery, right, in order to stay alive. And the university's decision was to fire that individual. And now that came after faculty members in the department where this adjunct was volunteered to step forward and take up the coursework to make sure the classes were covered. And then other faculty would say, listen, we'd be willing to donate our sick leave to this person to ensure that they're not going to lose medical insurance, that they're going to be able to have an income to be able to pay bills like rent, right, that you do. And the university was unmoved, and the state system of higher education in particular, right, ordered the local not to negotiate with the local union and to make sure this person was taken care of. Now, in the end, the one slice bit of good news here was that the union stepped forward and kind of helped establish a fund for this faculty member. And if I recall, close to $6,000 has been raised to make sure that this person's COBRA benefits will be covered, as well as rent and some other bills. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I know this is just one case, right? But how familiar is this kind of story when we're talking about adjunct conditions across the country?
It's unfortunately very familiar. It's the first time for me that it hit so very close to home, but I've been reading these stories for years. There was a professor at Duquesne University who famously made headlines. She had cancer and died while she was an adjunct for similar reasons. She couldn't pay her health care bills. She wasn't fully covered by the university. And since that time, we've seen stories in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, talking about how many adjunct professors are on welfare, how many of them are homeless, how many other jobs they have to work in order to keep teaching. So unfortunately, it's very familiar. Another thing that's unfortunate about that is that I think too often some well-meaning tenure line folks will respond by saying, well, they should just quit. You know, if this job won't pay their health care benefits, if they have to be
like
on
it,
food stamps, just leave. And what they don't realize is that, you know, these are folks like me who've spent years in graduate programs training for exactly this job.
Right.
And it is not easy for someone who's trained for, you know, 7, 8, 9 years to be a professor to suddenly say, oh, I'm going to recreate myself as something else. Some people have done that successfully, but it is hard to do. And it's not as easy as just saying, let's quit and do something else.
No, right. And it should be said, too, as well, is like unlike what we have in other industries, it's not as if there's not jobs, right? What there's a lack of are tenure track jobs, right?
Exactly.
And so you have people who are highly trained. They're coming because there's been a lot over the years, you know, talking about the overproduction of PhDs and things like this.
No, that's a fallacy.
Right, exactly. So because it's like the jobs are there. What we've seen shifted is, you know, just like we've seen everywhere across the country, right? We've seen this kind of neoliberal shift where you're going to look to kind of, you know, minimize the number of permanent faculty and kind of increase the kind of precarity that you have across the workforce. So, and I think that's that kind of misnomer, right? The idea that overproducing PhDs really needs to be addressed here because it, you know, said, well, they knew what they were signing up for and there's not a lot of jobs, the market's real bad. And that's not accurate, right?
Yeah.
There's reason why all these adjuncts have jobs, right?
Yeah.
It's just that the jobs suck.
Yeah, I mean, Mark Biscay analyzed this in How the University Works in 2008, and people are still using that poor logic of we're overproducing PhDs. No, we're not. You know, Biscay pointed out that we have enough positions, we're teaching enough classes to employ these folks on the tenure line, to employ them full time. It's the university's choice to do it through temporary contracts, through half-time contracts, because it's cheaper for them. And in fact, the system is set up so that we produced just enough that we need. I think he called it just in time.
Yep.
That's the case, and that isn't going to be solved by us shrinking graduate programs or preparing people for alternative careers. We have to get the administrations and the system to make a choice to employ people ethically.
Yeah, and I think this is underscored. I look at. So much of I'm trying not to just to go off on a diatribe here, right? But it's half of it. I mean, I think so much of this effort requires tenure line faculty members to actually rethink their relationship to this institution and what it is that we do here, right? Because too often what happens is that you have tenure line faculty members will kind of think about what they did and where they got and the job that they got simply is based solely upon their merit, that they're special, and that the reason why that adjunct faculty are adjunct is because they're not as special. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same kind of dynamic that we see happen all over the place right now. It's this kind of cult of meritocracy, but where meritocracy actually doesn't function, right? It's a myth that helps to kind of keep this division going.
Yeah, I've often told graduate students that I got my job because I'm lucky. Not that I'm not qualified for it, I am, but so were a lot of other folks. And that idea that special snowflakes get the jobs and the rest of them just aren't working hard enough is not the case. Nor is it the case that, it's just dues paying. I've heard that too. Well, I adjuncted for a year. And so I think those professors who are lucky enough to only adjunct for a year or not at all don't realize that that's not really how the system works. Most people who adjunct wind up doing nothing but adjuncting for the rest of their careers. That's why I think our contract in ABSCUF uses the term temporary faculty, and it's such a misnomer. You know, we have faculty who've been temporary for 5, 10 years.
Exactly. So, you know, this is a good place to take a break. So we're going to, when we come back, I want to talk one first about ABSCUF's contract, right? And kind of some of the differences we see here at ABSCUF, but also some of the challenges for going forward. And then also, what's the ask today, right? What are people asking? What's the kind of the goal of Campus Equity Week, and where does that kind of position us forward? So this is Kev Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back right after this with Amy Lynch Biniak, and this is Campus Equity Week at Kutztown University. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 6 years, we've brought unapologetic, progressive, activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond.
We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive, independent media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting, investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new, sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. After the Trump election, we dug in even deeper. Thanks to some longtime members, one-time donations, and a shift in other resources, we brought on more writers and started paying them. Now we're doubling down and want to expand our infrastructure and pay our writers even more. We need to invest in our media if we have a chance to resist the unprecedented assault on democracy, working families, women's rights, and our planet. History will remember the choices we make today. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a local craft beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways that you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support. Keep up the fight.
Welcome back to Raging Chickens. Out to Coop Extra, sitting here with Amy Lynch Bignac. She is the statewide chair, chair of the adjunct committee for ABSCUF, the statewide chair. And where we left off, we started to talk a little bit about ABSCUF's contract. Now, the thing is, and I've told the story numerous times, and listeners out to Coop have heard this before, but I first heard about ABSCUF, right, when I was actually living in Washington, D.C., working for the American Federation of Teachers. And I was working on temporary faculty issues. And I was updating report, and I had to call around the country just looking for language, contract language from different places that were addressing the issue, trying to find different ways of addressing the issue of precarity, basically, and so bringing in new language that was kind of victories and so on. And everybody that I spoke to were from the left coast to the right coast were said, you got to check out ABSCUF contract. So I did, right, and saw why they kept on pointing me to that. They kept on saying it was the gold standard, and said, so we wish we could get this, right? Now, so part of the protections we have in the contract, maybe you can tell us a little bit about what exists right now in terms of protections for temporary faculty members. But then we'll move on from there. I want to say, okay, just because it may be the gold standard doesn't mean that we're not without problems. So maybe you could walk back a little bit then and say, well, so what does the ABSCUF contract look like in terms of its the role, protections, or how does that look like in the contract as opposed to compared to some other places across the country?
Well, first of all, the fact that the temporary faculty, which is what they're called in our contract, there's many names, I know, that, and sometimes they can be contentious, that they call our contract calls them temporary faculty. The fact that they are part of the same union as the tenure line faculty is unusual in and of itself. That is happening at some places, but very often they're not welcome into the union with the tenure line faculty, unfortunately, and are having to create their own unions, sometimes through associations with workers' unions outside of education. So that in itself, I think, is impressive that we're one union. They share most of the same protections as tenure-line faculty. They have grievance rights, for instance. They have above-average pay, which, isn't saying too much, granted, since the average pay is, I think it's up to, like, $2,700 a course now. But they're typically making about $20,000 a year outside of KU. They make better than that in a PASHI school. They have better benefits typically than in other schools as well. We also have a policy which I think is really the shining star in our contract that allows temporary faculty temporary faculty to be converted to the tenure line after 5 years of service. Now, it has its own problems and snags as well, but it's so unusual that when I tell people from other systems about it, they want to see the contract language.
Yes.
The fact that we recognize that if someone is here for 5 years, it may be a sign, A, that we need someone permanently in that line, and B, that we value that individual professor if we've renewed their contract that many times.
And, you know, and that was the, from my understanding, too, that was the case to be made for why it is that even in our contract we have these folks called temporary, right? The idea was is that, no, if they're going to have adjuncts that are going to be there for temporary purposes, okay, we'll call them temporary, and then we're going to have the provisions in the contract which kind of says, okay, now we see these are not temporary positions, so let's roll them over. And I remember, you know, when I first started here in 2002, nobody was enforcing that kind of aspect of the contract. And now, I mean, you know this from in our own department, we've been very proactive then about shifting that and saying we need to use these provisions in the contract. And we have, you know, a significant segment of our department now are people who were formerly, quote unquote, temporary faculty members. But that's also the very thing that's now under threat, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Because it isn't financially efficient, I suppose, right? It goes back to budgets and the ways in which administration would rather save money. Because when you convert someone, then you have to convert them to a tenure line salary as well. And tenure line benefits. So it's more expensive to do that. But the investment in the professor is an investment in the whole system. It's an investment in our students, and we think it's worthwhile for that. But it's also, again, it's a social justice issue. If you're hiring somebody back year after year temporary, they're not temporary, right? You need to treat someone as you know, according to the position they actually have, whatever label you're slapping on it. You know, and I think that it's really important that we fight to protect that, but also to make sure that faculty across all of our 14 campuses understand their rights. Since I've worked with the adjunct faculty committee, I've discovered there's a lot of lore surrounding our conversion policy of the contract. It's one of the reasons it maybe wasn't enforced here for a while, and why it's so unevenly used across campuses. Some people, you know, mistakenly, they believe all sorts of crazy things, that if you use it, and that your department can be punished somehow, or that you're not allowed to have any more hires for 5 years. I've heard all sorts of things, and I keep saying, you know, show me that in the contract.
Right.
It doesn't say that. But, you know, people really need to know their contracts and understand their rights, and I think that is part of our goal as a union, is to try to disseminate information, because, you know, reading contracts, that's it's not fun. It's hard to understand exactly what's happening and what the repercussions are.
No, certainly. And that's, you know, that's one thing that you are not trained in when you're going to get your PhD is how to read contracts and how to think about your job in terms of labor. I know that everyone that is secondary on-the-job training what you do here. So let me ask you this then. So we know the past two contract fights with ABSCUF, one which led to ABSCUF's first ever strike last year, the issues were square on, right? Issues of adjunct faculty members. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, for two consecutive contracts now, the state system of higher education, that the chancellor's office, has sought to divide, like formally divide the faculty members for tenure line faculty and the temporary faculty. And there's a bunch of ways that they were proposing to do this. Everything from going to full on part-time piecework work, you know, academic work, to two tiers of faculty members that we paid on different scales, right? Everything to separate that stuff out. This ABSCUF contract will end next June, and there were all indications that we were gearing up for the same kind of stuff. Now, we had a chancellor who left, and now there's an interim chancellor, and ABSCUF now has a one-year contract, so there's a little bit of breathing room here. It's a one-year contract, and things have been pretty much status quo in that new contract. But all the indications are pointing toward that this is going to be kind of one of the key issues moving forward, right? So how do you see that challenge? How prepared do you think the union is, right, particularly in the kind of the tenure line faculty members, to understand that we need one union as opposed to, okay, I'm just going to take mine and sell off the rest.
Yeah, I think that's key. I mean, certainly our temporary colleagues understand what's at stake. They live that reality every day. I think that where we need to do work is among the tenure line faculty and help everyone to realize that this affects all of us, that it, you know, the adjunctification of higher education is what's leading to, for instance, the fact that we're all doing a heck of a lot more work with less. So I think about how much of my time is spent in meeting after meeting after meeting and doing assessment work and service work. There are fewer tenure line faculty to shoulder those burdens because conventionally we don't give that work to our temporary colleagues, although many of them do.
Right.
They've stepped up to help because we simply can't get it all done. You know, helping them understand the long-term effects of this on education generally, I think, is really important, and it's where we need to do a lot of work. I think, unfortunately, between contracts, a lot of tenure line faculty don't think about this issue at all. I just have a post that I think is going up on EBSCoff's blog today that titled "We Can Do Better." That I think I've been very impressed at how we've stood up shoulder to shoulder with our adjunct colleagues in moments of crisis, but I'd like to see us do that between contract negotiations. I think it would make the challenge of contract negotiations a little bit easier. I think it's not so much preparing for the potential of a strike, but changing the culture of how we talk about labor and how we talk about our temporary colleagues every day in department meetings when we're scheduling with the chair. I would love to see department chairs care as much about the scheduling needs and concerns of their temporary colleagues as they do their tenure line colleagues. I would like us to ask questions about staffing in every meeting we're in. How are we going to staff that? I would like to see tenure line faculty who see bullpen offices and shared computers and stuff like that call their deans and say, hey, what is this about? Can we do better than this? And advocate for those kinds of changes. That if we do that every day between contracts, then there's more momentum to use to fight those larger fights, you know, during a contract.
Well, and I think that, I mean, there is exactly the point in my mind, right? I mean, because it's that dailiness that is going to, kind of position us better for the longer fights. Because the way I look at this is ultimately what we've got on our hands is a political fight, right? I mean, we talk about long-term kind of disinvestment from higher education, especially at the state university systems and so on. And that has been, let's say it, let's be frank about it, it's been a bipartisan move that's happened over 30, 40 years, right? Because it's convenient to kind of buy into the kind of, lower taxes and, let's public-private partnership stuff, which has been exactly part and parcel to this kind of move to squeeze universities to kind of foreground austerity measures, right, and to decrease the number of tenure line faculty members and the people who are on the front lines, the adjunct faculty members, to just kind of fully on exploit them, right? That is the kind of the legacy of the past 30, 40 years. And if we're and again, we're not alone in this at this university, certainly, but I think EBSCoff is well positioned actually to say, okay, we can do this organizational work precisely because we have one union, right? And then it's say, well, how do we build this, the fight for the long haul? Because we're going to need it both at the state level when it comes to funding battles and budget battles, but also I think kind of serving as a model for what's possible in higher education if we just refuse to just buy into the kind of tip of the nose thinking, which is about, I just need to get mine now and screw the rest of us.
And I think when we stood up and went on strike last year, that was exactly the message, that we are willing to stand up as one union, and it made a tremendous difference. And as long as we can keep that momentum going every day, I think that we can make a difference. We can fend off some of those changes. We can demand that labor be treated more fairly. I'm very proud of what we did, and I'm learning every day ways we can organize and advocate and It takes all of us, though. I mean, I keep reminding people that you can't say, well, the union will take care of that. Well, you are the union. Mm-hmm. We all have to do these things. So, for instance, you mentioned the temporary faculty member who was fired because he or she couldn't work after getting sick and couldn't pay rent and health care costs. My committee is working on language that we can recommend to the negotiations committee. We're working on that now, having learned from that, saying, okay, how do we put something in the contract that will allow tenure-line faculty to donate sick days, that will prevent something like that from happening again? That we have to pay attention to the issues happening on our campus and think about how they can inform a better contract, not just for that campus or that department, but for the entire system.
Oh, awesome. Well, let's bring it back here then to Campus Equity Week. The reason why we're sitting here in what I'd like to affectionately call the dead president's room at Kutztown University.
Yeah.
Literally, there's pictures of dead presidents all over the place. I mean, presidents of the university, so I just to be clear about this. I have to say this, and we're sitting under the newly hung portrait of Guido Piccini, who was actually the chair of the Board of Governors. He's a member of the Kutztown's Board of Trustees, Guido Piccini. If anybody's been following Raging Chicken over the past years, you know that we've been written about him extensively, especially since he wanted to hire chancellors in the secret sessions, right, with confidentiality. Anyways, that's a total side point. But that's where we're kind of sitting. But the reason we're here is for Campus Equity Week. So, okay, so people come. I mean, I see that you've got, information up around the room. And, of course, like any good action, you've got coffee and treats.
Coffee and sugar. Come on, man.
Yeah. But lots of kind of information and so on. So put this in the realm of the ask. Like, what is the goal of Campus Equity Week, say, across the country? What do you hope to kind of come out of what we see here today? And what is, why this week exists to begin with? What do we want?
Well, we want, first of all, people to have that information. I even talked about how, among our compatriots, a lot of them aren't aware of their rights within the contract. So just letting students and faculty and administrators know what the issues are. So many of our students don't know what adjuncts are, that some of their professors are adjuncts. I think the more of us know and understand these issues, the better. We can have these conversations. But more than that, I'm hoping that all of us across the country who are having these events can motivate individuals to take some action, to do something, anything. We live in an age, I think, where people are beginning to realize, I need to get off my couch and do something. And it doesn't have to be protesting in the streets. It doesn't have to be walking a picket line.
Although
it can be. Absolutely, it can be. And I encourage that. But what activism means for everybody is different, and it might be, going to Facebook, which I recently rejoined.
By the way, folks, that would be an awesome conversation on the side, just because it would be freaking amazing to hear Amy's struggles with Facebook. But that's a whole other for another day.
Facebook. I'm back on Facebook, but I rejoined it for a group called Tenure for the Common Good. And these are tenure-line faculty from across the nation who are saying, okay, what are the things that we can do? Those little things that we can do. So one of the things that I'm asking people who stop into our event today to do is to look, for instance, at the letter that Facebook group has composed for U.S. News and World Report. As you know, they rank universities every year, and a lot of students and parents make decisions based on those rankings. And what this letter points out is that currently only 5% of that category is dedicated to what a university's labor structure is like, how many part-time and full-time faculty they have. And we'd like to see that count for more. They also give 35% of their ratings to faculty salaries, but they don't count adjunct salaries in that, which is astounding to me. So like a tiny thing that people can do is sign this letter, which already has over 1,000 signatures on it, which is going to U.S. News Report, and we're hoping that they will make a change. We can actually affect some change. It's been picked up by the press. It's getting momentum. I want people to realize there's lots of ways that they can contribute and be active to make a difference.
Well, it's awesome, and I love the way that that's positioned as tenure for the common good, because that's exactly kind of what this is about. And too often we think about adjunct faculty as just a kind of almost like an identity category. This is just about this group over here, when really it's about the state of higher education, right? And what does it look like to actually make sure that this is an endeavor that continues? So we will put links to tenure for the common good. We will put links to the letter that Amy was just talking about, and also link a bunch of her awesome work on contingency and adjunct faculty across the state, and or across the country, rather, and her, as soon as it's up, her blog post over at ABSCUF, kind of laying out issues around Campus Equity Week and what we need to be doing here as a union and as a people if we give half a crap about democracy in the future of this country. So now I would be remiss if I let you go without delving into the critical realm of Star Trek Discovery. So now I don't mean it's a disrespect to the Campus Equity Week, but as everyone, if you listen out to Coop, you know that we do space news every week, and I've been hyping this up somewhat. So give me your quick reactions of what you're thinking about Star Trek Discovery.
Well, first of all, if you make anything and call it Star Trek, you can take my money. So I was going to watch it anyway, but I'm very much enjoying this kind of darker and, dare I say, more adult Star Trek. I was wary. I didn't know what it was going to be like, but I think that they're delving into kind of a less shiny version of Roddenberry's future. He liked to show in the original series and in the Next Generation, you know, what we eventually are able to be, where, you know, there's no racism and there's no sexism and there's no money, for goodness sakes. But here we're seeing in this prequel, you know, the struggle to get there. And to me, that's fascinating to see that there's, you know, Federation people and Starfleet people with dark sides, and they're struggling, wrestling with ethics. I dig it. I do.
Yeah,
I like it a lot.
I think it's been pretty cool. And like I said, you know, I shared you that one article from Rolling Stone, which is, I think it was Rolling Stone article that says that, you know, this, the producers of it were explicit about it, said this is Star Trek for the Trump era.
Yeah.
Basically saying this is, you know, we're going to raise those issues about, you know, about racism, about kind of supremacy, racial supremacy that we see, and the darker side of folks. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, before this, the only time we really got to see some of those issues in the Star Trek universe or whatever was, you go like Deep Space Nine, for example, but that's really kind of on the edge of things, so it's always put off on the other. Here you're seeing this happening inside the belly of Starfleet, but so pretty cool. So,
and the ships look cool.
Yeah,
oh,
they do.
Man.
They do. I've got my Star Trek Discovery shirt that I'll be wearing for Halloween tomorrow. So,
and I totally want. Have you seen the disco shirts? Are you caught up on your episodes?
I have seen. Yes, I'm caught up.
I want a disco shirt so bad, man.
Well, I just actually got the Starfleet varsity jacket, so I'm completely geeked out on this. I'm really interested to see if how much we're going to get into the kind of, say, labor issues we're talking about here, if they're going to actually bring that up. And we've had some inklings of this already in the series, and I'm just kind of looking forward to it. So thank you for indulging me.
Anytime you want to talk labor or Star Trek or both, I'm down.
There you have it, the labor of Star Trek. All right. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in for this Out to Coop Extra. And like I said, please check out the show notes for links to Amy's work, information about Campus Equity Week, and what you can do to support the fight for justice. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Thanks for tuning in. See ya!